This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This is a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. Huddled together in frigid temperatures, carrying signs that read "No Blood for Oil," an estimated 25,000 protesters rallied yesterday at Boston Common in Massachusetts. Howard Zinn, professor emeritus at Boston University, was among the speakers. He spoke of terrorism, calling war itself a form of terrorism. During a conversation with Zinn earlier today on Peace Watch, he continued the discussion. Professor Zinn, you spoke to the crowd about terrorism. You said, quote, "War breeds terrorism. War is terrorism." Mm. Millions of Americans embraced the Bush administration's position that wiping out Iraqi President Saddam Hussein will keep America safe from a possible terrorist attack on the U.S. Mm. Is that a logical conclusion to reach, in your opinion?
Well, there's no evidence there's a connection between Saddam Hussein, as bad as he is, but no evidence at all that there's a connection between him and the terrorist attack of 9/11 or any of the other terrorist attacks. And what is happening is the administration is straining very hard to create a connection in the minds of people where there is none. And in fact, I think the impending war on Iraq is an attempt to divert the attention of the public from the fact that the United States has been unsuccessful in a so-called war against terrorism. Unsuccessful because there's no possible way that making war on Afghanistan is going to have any serious effect on terrorism. Terrorism isn't a something that is located in one place like Afghanistan or one place anywhere on the planet. And in fact, as Bush himself said in his State of the Union address, he said, you know, there are tens of thousands of trained terrorists around the world, over a dozen countries where terrorists may spring from. So to single out Afghanistan or to single out Iraq is just, I think, a way of diverting the attention of the public from the fact that you cannot make war on terrorism. And so I suspect there are other motives besides ending terrorism that are behind the war on Iraq, just as they were behind the war in Afghanistan.
At the same time, however, Professor Zinn, there are those who don't necessarily support the war against Iraq, but they think that probably someone other than Saddam, getting rid of Saddam Hussein is a good idea.
Getting rid of Saddam Hussein is a good idea. You know, getting rid of the monarchs of Saudi Arabia is a good idea. Getting rid of the people who lead Syria is a good idea. Getting rid of Sharon is a good idea. There are many, many tyrants in the world who should be removed and democracy replacing their tyranny. But you don't go to war against every country that has a tyrant because it would be better to have a different kind of government in there. Not only that, but the record of the United States in you know, what is called regime change, the record of the United States in trying to change regimes, or in fact succeeding in changing regimes, is a very miserable one, very odious one, because the United States has changed regimes in the past.
Changed to what, however?
That's right. It's changed democratic regimes to dictatorships. It did that in Guatemala in 1954. It went after the regime change in Guatemala, and there was a democratically elected president, not a dictator, not a tyrant. And the United States covertly created a rebellion against him, overthrew him by a military coup, and instituted basically a terrorist regime. It did the same thing in Chile in 1973 when it secretly worked to overthrow the government of Allende, a democratically elected government, not a tyranny.
And Chavez. And
then, of course, in 1953, there too, you know, the government of the United States worked secretly, overthrew the Mossadegh regime in Iran. And why? Because it was nationalizing the oil fields. It was acting against the oil corporations. And what was the result? Putting in the Shah with his secret police and his own terrorism. So And of course, and then there's Vietnam. There's the United States trying to create, actually creating a government in Vietnam, setting up the Diem regime in Vietnam, and then, which certainly was no democratic regime, and then when that regime didn't do what the United States wanted to do, secretly acting to overthrow it. In other words, the record of the United States in creating democracies in the world is nothing to be proud of. So to think that the United States is going to create a democracy, you know, in Iraq, just isn't borne out by history. Mm. And then, there's the other question.
Regime.
At what cost? At what human cost? Even if you get rid of Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know who's going to replace him, first of all. You don't know if you're going to then have a democracy. And we removed the Taliban in Afghanistan, true, but there's no democracy in Afghanistan either. But then there's the question of the cost. Suppose you remove Saddam Hussein, but in the meantime you've killed tens of thousands of Iraqis. Now maybe there won't be many Americans who get killed, because we have this high-tech, warfare. But we need to think about the Iraqis who are killed, because the Iraqis who are killed, they're not Saddam Hussein. They're the victims of Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
And it's this irony that when you go to war against the tyrant, you kill the victims of the tyrant.
Not the tyrant, often.
That's right.
And then there's regime change that begins at home.
Oh, well, we could use regime change here. I mean, when we talk about instituting democracy in Iraq or another country, I think we need to institute democracy in the United States. After all, here's a government which I would say was not democratically elected. It was not elected by a majority of the electorate. It was put into power by the Supreme Court. It was a kind of legalistic coup. Furthermore, this government, which was not elected by a majority of the people, sets out to put the Bill of Rights aside and to declare a state of emergency, a state of war, and to begin to curtail the democratic rights of citizens and non-citizens who are supposed also to have constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
So, democracy is in danger in the United States, and I think we could use a regime change here.
Professor Zinn, one of the reasons, although not often stated, for the Bush administration justifying its impending war against Iraq is the fact that it's said that Saddam Hussein attempted to assassinate the elder President Bush.
Well,
is that not a fair
reason to have to go
and attack Saddam Hussein?
Well, even if it were true, the fact that an assassination attempt has been made is a reason for going to war. If that were the case, then Cuba would have a reason for going to war against the United States, since the United States made a number of assassination attempts against Castro, and the United States has made assassination attempts against rulers in Africa, probably was, responsible for the assassination of Lumumba. And so the United States... Then there are countries that could say, we must go to war. No, that's no reason to go to war. Besides, the evidence, even the evidence for that, Iraq was behind the assassination attempt of the senior Bush, the evidence for that has never been brought forth at all. It's just one of those statements that's made without evidence. And then if you make a statement again and again, I guess the argument, the supposition is if you make a statement that has no evidence, but you make it 20 times, suddenly it has evidence.
Mm-hmm. You're a professor at Boston University. Is the war a big issue on that campus?
Well, I'm a professor emeritus, which means I'm hardly there on the campus, although I was there at a teach-in last week, which was a packed house, and so, yes, it is an issue on campus. There was a teach-in on the war, and yesterday at the rally on the Boston Common. There was a large contingent from Boston University. And in fact, I think it's fair to say that the war is an issue on just about every campus in Boston. There are teach-ins all over the city. As I understand, there have been teach-ins all over the country.
Boston University Professor Emeritus Howard Zinn. The sanctions against Iraq continue despite documented genocidal impact on the children of Iraq. Barbara Nimri Aziz of WBAI and the Iraqi children have asked, Iraq, how can I forget?
My name is Payman Jeff. My original is from Iraq. How can I forget?
This is a report on Iraq 5 years after sanctions took effect. That embargo silently continues to wreak havoc and challenge its youth. Few outsiders have heard the experience of Iraqis, especially its young people. Who are they, and how do they feel?
I hope they know the right things about Iraq and don't think that we are uneducated and ignorant.
We will stand there.
In other countries, like people my age will know how I think, and, you know, maybe they'll be affected about what I say, and that's really good.
The bombing cut electrical services throughout the country. Without electricity and gasoline, you have things resulting, as we see, in starvation.
And the blockade will go on. I'm sure of that. But in the same time, I'll tell you, there's people suffering from the blockade. This is the real damage for the blockade. Children leave their schools to help their families to get money or to live. They will have no interviews to make them know that there's a blockade in Iraq. There's people suffering in Iraq. People die. A lot of people die for the blockade. No medicine. No milk for children. You know that? They destroyed everything.
The Iraqi people love the bridges. Do you know that one man stand near the bridge when the ally destroyed it? And he cry, and he suicide? It means symbol. We didn't feel it till they broke the bridges. We feel that they destroy the culture. Destroy the meaning of the something. It means so much to us. Before I wrote a love song about bridge al-jisr al-mu'allaq. ضلعي أحس المنكسر موش الجسر يا جسر المعلق ويا أحلى جسر.
I am Palestinian. Do you hear me shouting across the electric barricade? I am Iraqi, Baghdad bridges falling down. I am Kurdish. Do you hear me rustling the mountain, falling down, falling down? I am Lebanese. I am finding the torn limbs of my child's corpse in different flower pots. I am Egyptian. Take the key and lock them up. I am Sudanese. My black arms shimmer and swing under my tobe, and they also shudder. I am Algerian. Lock them up, lock them up. I am Tunisian. I am estranged from my husband and my father. I am Somali. My food truck is gunned down by 4 different groups of my countrymen. I am Iranian. I am Afghani. I have turned my hero's guns against my brothers. I am Punjabi. I am Pakistani, I am Indian, all the bridges falling down. I am Kashmiri, falling down. I am Bengali. Is that the rustle of my sari or the floods beginning? I am Myanmar. Time magazine sniggers at my name. I am Cambodian. Lock them up, lock them up. I am Indonesian, my brown lady. I am Chichan. I am Azeri. Is that the rustle of gunfire or the mountain falling? I am Kazakh, I am Turkestani, I am estranged from my mother and my son. I am Turkish, the EEC won't let me in. Let me in, let me in, my fair lady. I am Balkan, I am Albanian, I am Bosnian. Can you hear the screams of my daughter being raped? I think this is the 15th time. Can you take responsibility for your actions? There are no more new countries, the earth is filled. I cannot bear the news of one more dead child, head hanging limply off the crook of somebody's arm, whatever the religion of the arm. Do you hear me? There is an imbalance in the arms. I said, do you hear me shouting across the electric barricade? I am a refugee. I am one of the 85%. I am nothing. I am dead. I am a Muslim rising, bearing witness, bearing responsibility for my own past, for all my actions, and I will accept no less from all the world.
Voices of and for the Iraqi people, produced by Barbara Nimri Aziz of WBAI. Last week, we heard the history of the relationship between Europe, Iraq, and the USA as far as 1920, as described by Hidden Wars of Desert Storm. Tonight, we pick up where we left off with the weapons inspector's entrance into Iraq.
We uncovered the bulk of what the Iraqis were able to produce in terms of chemical weapons, biological weapons, ballistic missiles, and nuclear weapons.
Former UNSCOM team leader Scott Ritter.
The infrastructure that Iraq used to produce these weapons has largely been dismantled, destroyed, or under monitoring by the weapons inspectors. So we have a good idea of what should be left. It's not very much.
Despite that, the U.S. has consistently moved the goalposts and said it's not enough if they abide by the requirements regarding weapons of mass destruction. Instead of saying, if you abide by the requirements of the U.N. resolution, sanctions will be lifted, the U.S. message is, it doesn't matter whether you comply or not, we're not going to lift sanctions anyway.
Dennis Halliday.
When UNSCOM began, I believe it was an legitimate effort to track down and destroy dangerous weaponry. And in fact, the Atomic Energy Agency and others were just about ready to clear UNSCOM, their work, and agree that Iraq was clean. Then Richard Butler was appointed, and he reopened many of the issues that in fact had been closed and seemed to bring a new element to the investigation, perhaps very much supported by Washington.
Scott Ritter.
Unfortunately, the actions of its executive chairman, Richard Butler, in concert with the United States government, allowed UNSCOM to be manipulated in a way which was outside the guidelines set forth by its true boss, the Security Council. The United States and the United Kingdom used UNSCOM as a trigger for the initiation of military action. The United States and Great Britain used information gathered by weapons inspectors to provide targets for their bombing. This is an accepted fact. So UNSCOM as an organization has been discredited.
Dennis Halliday.
It's true that an inspection entity of that sort can be manipulated politically and give an excuse to the more aggressive member states for further military action. And in a sense, we have that every day, almost every day of the week, when UK and American planes are bombing Iraq.
Nasir Asadoum, Director, Gulf War Foundation, Baghdad.
The Americans are bombing what they call the Iraqi radars, which is not true. They are bombing infrastructure. They are bombing homes of people. They have even bombed a tent of Bedouins with their animals, with the whole family who are dead. Every single day there was a bombing of Iraq. But not one of the media have spoken about that.
Rhonda Habib, Agence France-Presse, Jordan.
Now, if you don't see it in the media abroad, it's because I think people are, you know, and it's becoming too small a story for it's not as interesting as before.
Journalist and writer in Jordan, Michel Haj.
On the 17th of January 1993, Bush sent 42 missiles on that date. One of them hit Al-Rashid Hotel when I was there.
David Welch, U.S. State Department.
The air attacks that you refer to are defensive in nature. Since 1991, there has been a no-fly zone in the north of Iraq. This no-fly zone was imposed, I will recall for your audience, after the Iraqi regime forced the exodus of over 500,000 Kurdish inhabitants of northern Iraq. The UN passed Resolution 688 that said that this should not happen, and then a no-fly zone was imposed in the north.
There is no reference in any UN resolution to the establishment of no-fly zones in northern or southern Iraq.
Phyllis Bennis, Institute for Policy Studies.
The U.S. has imposed them and, with the British, kept them in place, and the result is that civilians in the north and in the south, whose lives ostensibly are to be protected by the establishment of those no-fly zones, are being killed not by Iraqi soldiers or Iraqi planes, but by American bombings that go off course. That's who is killing the Iraqi civilians now in the northern and southern no-fly zones. One of the very bitter lessons of these years of war, both economic war and military war against Iraq, is that for the United States government, and I think for most governments in the Security Council, humanitarian considerations are simply not enough to influence policy. We have, of course, the famous statement by Madeleine Albright in 1996 when she was asked about the deaths at that time of 500,000 Iraqi children that have died as the result of sanctions. And, of course, she did not dispute the figure. She simply thought about it for a moment and then said, on balance, we think it's worth it.
The 60-minute show entitled Punishing Saddam, where State Secretary Madeleine Albright made this insensitive remark, aired on May the 12th, 1996. It has since been censored by CBS under political pressure. If, indeed, the price is worth it, as Ms. Albright declared, again, who is paying that price? And what does it buy? Is it really an attempt to force Saddam out of power, as is being claimed by the United States administration?
David Welch, U.S. State Department.
Well, the Iraqi Liberation Act is an additional expression of our concern about the regime that's in charge in Baghdad. The United States believes that this situation involving Iraq would be immeasurably better were Saddam Hussein no longer the leader of Iraq. The act passed by Congress is designed to provide support and resources.
According to the Iraqi Liberation Act, they said that they are ready to give the Iraqi opposition non-lethal equipment.
Writer with the Iraqi opposition, Ahmed Al-Jabbar.
They are thinking about computers and mobiles and desks and so on, and I don't think that by mobiles and computers we will be able to remove Saddam Hussein from power.
In other parts of the world, Washington has never proved to come short of ideas and solid means to get rid of governments deemed hostile or worth removing.
In 1992, when we first established the INC, we were planning to have an uprising, national resistance against the regime. In April 1995, we started this uprising, the military operation of it, but the Americans refused again to support that uprising, and Saddam Hussein was able to crush it.
To this day, Saddam Hussein remains Washington's most convenient bogeyman, justifying the continuing pressure on Iraq and in the Gulf region in general.
Former director of the UN Iraq program, Dennis Halliday.
There was a belief, I think, for many years that somehow sanctions would lead to the removal of Saddam Hussein. Very naive, because in fact, economic sanctions and their impact have made Saddam Hussein stronger.
Why the embargo strengthened the regime of Saddam Hussein?
Former Iraqi oil minister Fadel Chalabi.
First, because the mere livelihood of people became dependent on the government. He controlled people through starving them. But more important is that the embargo created a new class living very comfortably attached to him. You see nobody getting 100 times as much as a doctor. Why? Because he is part of the security system. And therefore he should be fed well, he should be given good accommodation. He created a power base of people whose daily interests were tied to him, so that when he goes, they lose all these privileges.
Dennis Halliday, former director of the UN Iraq program.
Sanctions have sustained Saddam Hussein in power, and there are many of us worldwide who believe that is also a policy of the United States. Because of the Saddam Hussein threat, quote-unquote, the Americans have sold arms on a massive scale to the Arab states, the Gulf, Israel, of course, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia.
International arms trade analyst Bill Hartung.
After the Gulf War, U.S. arms manufacturers and the Pentagon took advantage of making new arms sales to the Middle East at the rate of about $1 billion a month.
Marwan al-Hassem, former Jordanian foreign minister.
The oil-producing countries in 1990 had hundreds of billions of dollars in reserve. Now they have maybe hundreds of billions in debt.
Hidden Wars of Desert Storm documentary. The soundtrack by composer Fritz Heed and the narration done by actor John Hurt. Pacifica's Peace Watch was produced today by Scott Gurian, engineered by Granger Helvey, consultants Larry Bensky and Sam Husseini. Our editor was Reem Kathuta. We had production assistance from Sidrak Franklin of WPFW and web help from Pete Caracas and RadioForAll.net. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.